You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education Issue Review podcast for the edition covering the 7th to the 13th of April 2016. My name is John Elms and I'm joined today by reporters Chris Havergal, Matthew Rice and David Matthews. And in our pages this week, the extent to which the next Research Excellence Framework should focus on overall university performance has emerged as a key battleground between the Russell Group and other parts of the sector. David has written that and he'll be taking us through it just shortly. Moving on, Chris has been looking at some research about the depiction of academics on the small screen and will be taking us through some of the more well-known fictional scholars from the world of television. And covering our feature section, David will be returning to take us through his cover feature about academic social networks and their priorities, while Matthew will be drawing from a poignant piece about an academic's experiences on a psychiatric ward following a bout of depression. First, David, you've been covering a clash over the next ref. What's been going on?
That's right. So there's a big review of the ref currently being conducted. It's being led by Lord Stern of Climate Change Report fame. He's going to report in the summer and it's been calling for evidence. And it essentially will look at reducing bureaucracy in the ref, whether they can use metrics. But what I've focused on in this piece about the submissions so far is it seems to be a bit of a clash moment between the big research universities in the Russell Group and the University Alliance of more modern universities. One of the things that Stern and everyone will be looking at in the review is whether in the next ref certain things, perhaps the impact research has, perhaps the environment research is conducted in, should be reported at more institutional level. Because at the moment you get an individualised score based on what's called a unit of assessment, which is effectively a department or a subject within a university. Mm. So, you know, one university can have a brilliant physics department, but a terrible sports science department, for example. And that is, so it's pretty granulated. What people fear would happen, or the University Alliance fears would happen, if you started looking at things more by university, is that the universities that are already doing very well out of the ref and get lots of money in from their results would just get even more money. Mm-hmm. So it would cement an advantage. Whereas the Russell Group argue that they're having a kind of critical mass of lots of really good research and lots of departments is a really good thing. You can have lots of really good interdisciplinary research and so on. So they want more of a institutional view. It's basically politicking, essentially, jockeying for position ahead of what's going to happen. There's all kinds of other things in the responses as well I looked at. Most people seem to be pretty down on using metrics. Mm-hmm. So at the moment, the ref is all generally based on peer review, but the government keeps coming back to this idea that if they should use things like citation data and metric, basically numbers, to judge things, and it keeps being battered away. And they brought it up again, and now the sector's saying, no, this is not a good idea. So, yeah, it's like a dog with a bone. The government can't leave it alone, but the sector keeps saying, no, it's not a good idea. So that's what's happening, and we'll find out what Lord Stern says in the summer.
Yeah, because the ref is so important for all institutions in the country, these arguments and discussions and debates are always going to crop up, aren't they? I mean, this is quite a significant one, though, isn't it?
It's huge. I mean, the ref determines, the result of the ref determine quality-related funding, so the kind of block grant funding that universities get, and that's more than £1 billion a year, so it's huge. Lots of universities don't really get much money from it. However, it is really important. It is nonetheless important because they gives them a ranking of their academics and their departments. Mm. So it's not just used for getting money. It's all about an exercise to make the whole to see what's happening in your university. So you can imagine some people being kind of annoyed if suddenly things were reported, emphasised at an institutional level, because they might not know in detail what's going on in their university, even if there's not much money linked to it.
Absolutely. David's piece is on pages 6 and 7, and it's a very interesting one, which I'm sure that a lot of people would have an opinion on from both sides of the coin. Chris, you've been looking at a slightly more irreverent piece of research, if that's the right word. Take us through what you've been finding out.
Yeah, there's nothing like a good piece of academic research to take the fun out of some of your favourite TV shows. This is Barbara Tobolowski, who's an associate professor in educational leadership and policy studies at the University of Texas at Arlington. She has done a very interesting study, actually. The research was perhaps more enjoyable than some research projects in that she watched 12 series that were aired on the US TV between 1996 and 2014 that were set wholly or perhaps in part on university campuses. So it's got lots of shows which are very well known in the UK and indeed around the world. So shows like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Boy Meets World, and Fur Drop from the Sun. John Lithgow's character Dick Solomon in that being a physicist. Also some shows which perhaps aren't quite so well known. But what Dr. Tobolowski has done is analysed the portrayal of academics in these shows and sort of explores what it says about academics' place in US society. I mean, in terms of her findings, she finds that in terms of their personal lives and their lifestyles, academics are usually presented as being, I guess non-traditional is the word that could be used to describe it. They're often, I mean, that's used in quite a conservative small c sense, in the sense that they're often single, lonely, may have a drink problem, and also highly promiscuous, often with a promiscuous interest in their own students. So academics may be left asking whether TV really does reflect reality in this case. But it's not just about personal relationships. It also looks at relationships between academics and finds that in TV they're usually portrayed as being pretty contemptuous of each other. In Third Rock from the Sun, Dick Solomon is seen reading A Brief History of Time by Stephen Hawking before tossing it aside and remarking that people on this planet will swallow anything, Dick Solomon being an alien, of course. And also it looks at their research activity and basically finds academics in American TV series don't really do any research. But when their colleagues try to do some, they're usually very dismissive of it and say that it's so obscure that it's absolutely useless.
Right, so, I mean, quite a lot of things that I imagine many academics would turn their nose up at, many authentic academics as opposed to fictional ones, but...
I think what the research does try to sort of bring it around and say, well, actually, what does this mean about the way that academics are thought of in society? Her argument is that there's a very strong strain of anti-intellectualism in US society, where academics are often viewed as being shady, deceitful, or pompous. And it's not clear whether those perceptions are sort of created by TV drama or more likely sort of reinforced, you know, existing perceptions being reinforced by TV drama. But certainly Barbara Tobolowski says the television images are strong, consistent and oft repeated.
Absolutely. Well, Chris's story is on page 16. Thoroughly worth a look, whether you agree with the research or not. I think there's some interesting things to be drawn out of. And he does actually state the truth. It might ruin some of your favourite comedies. I don't know. But yes, moving on to our feature section, returning to you, David. You've also been, well, more to do with research as well. Academic social networks. What have you been writing about here?
Right, so... Yeah, this feature looks at something that's become, you know, a very common part of academics' lives, academic social networks. And the three we've focused on are academia.edu, ResearchGate, and Mendeley. Lots and lots of academics use these, but there's not really been much discussion of, first of all, how it might change research and how people discover new papers and so on, and which one is the biggest, and what their plans are, because they're all to some extent for profit, or at least for part of for profit companies. Right. So we've got the latest data on what's happening in terms of usage, and although academia.edu seems to have more registered users, it seems like ResearchGate is far more widely used than academia.edu, particularly in the science disciplines, and particularly on continental Europe. I mean, in pretty much every territory it's used more, but academia.edu seems to be used a bit more in the kind of Anglophone countries. So that's kind of interesting. I also go through the various business models, because academia.edu and ResearchGate are owned by venture capitalists, and therefore, you know, they will be expected to turn a profit at some point, you would assume. Don't know what the timescales are on that, but that's the idea if you're owned by venture capitalists. So talking about how on earth do these sites make money, I mean, social networks aren't brilliant at making money. Twitter isn't very good at making money. Facebook is. And ResearchGate basically think that an advertising model can work. Right. So, you know, if you're a scientist and you're looking through a paper and it mentions a particular microscope that's being used, you can quickly find reviews of this microscope and just click on it. And they make a fair point, that there is a lot of money flowing through science. And if you can target these adverts well, you can do pretty well. I mean, you know, it's going to make you far more money from advertisers than Facebook ever did. Academia.edu, less clear, I think, it would be fair to say, how it's going to make money. I mean, there was a sort of great big hoo-ha after they suggested to one user that they might basically charge for recommendations on the site, but this was quickly shot down. They're also possibly toying with becoming kind of low-cost publisher, but then there are lots of those as well, like PLOS and F1000 and so on. So that's interesting. And then we also discuss how this might change how academics find their research. I mean, Facebook has been criticised for essentially exposing people just a bubble of information that confirms their prejudices and their worldview, because it's all from their friends. Then you've also got an algorithm that filters what you're most interested in. And there's probably not people making the point that this might lead to tunnel vision amongst researchers. So if you're always reading the most popular thing, you know, it could create real problems in terms of overturning scientific paradigms and finding new and interesting research. So there's and there's also some scholars, going back to the commercial point, that just don't like using for-profit networks at all. They think, can the university sector do its own thing and take control of the algorithms they use? They just feel that, you know, having lots of your time as an academic spent on these networks with these particular ways of finding research could be problematic. So yeah, it's fascinating, and hopefully it should be touch on issues for all academics who use these networks. So yeah, give it a read.
Absolutely. And also, presumably you spoke to some academics about their usage of it.
Yeah.
I mean, what are the academics' views about these sites?
Well, I think people, to be fair to the networks, a lot of people really like them. I mean, it helps you discover new research. Also for young, early career researchers, because they're not attached to a specific institution, it helps them get their name out there. So they've got a kind of good online presence where they can display what they've done and who they are. Even though they might be going from 1 year postdoc to 1 year postdoc, so that's kind of positive. But then, of course, that creates lots of work. You know, you've got to keep on updating this. I mean, Twitter and Facebook and LinkedIn are enough, more than enough, as we all know. Sure, I mean, God knows how long you'd spend if you also had to do three academic networks, or even there's loads of them. So
absolutely,
it could create a big workload.
Right. Well, David's feature starts on page 38. Very interesting piece. I recommend you take a look at it. Matthew, this piece that you're going to take us through wasn't written by you, but it's a very important piece for the higher education sector. deals with some mental health issues. And what particularly is this academic talking about when they write it?
Well, this is the personal testimony of an academic who wanted to remain anonymous. But he was having a sort of ordinary day and go to the post office and so on, and then he went to see his doctor and sort of started talking about his feelings and being, you know, upset and so on. And his doctor sort of said, you know, sort of ordered an ambulance and said, you need to be in a psychiatric ward and you need to be treated. And so he was, you know, taken there, and, you know, immediately he, you know, he was there for several days, I think, and he wasn't allowed to shave without someone, you know, unobserved. You know, all the cutlery wasn't met, you know, there was no metal cutlery and so on. He happened, one of the days happened to be a teaching day, and he could see the tower of the university where he has an office out of the window. So it was a kind of completely, complete upheaval to his life. And it is, you know, basically a sort of poignant personal testimony. And I think he comments a bit on the sort of lack of provision for psychiatric patients, basically, in America, but I'm sure the same applies here. I mean, he says in the entire state of Texas, only has 10 meagre facilities into which visitors now can now take guns. So this is, he also, I mean, his own experience was, you know, he's felt very well supported both by family and by, after he emerged, by the kind of help he's received. But he does also speculate about whether this isn't a particular danger for academics, or can be, and that it's very much not talked about, which is why he wrote the article. And he says, you know, if you're working the humanities on a long project, it's a very sort of introverted process. You're on your own. You may not think you're making any progress for a while, and if you're at all sort of melancholic by temperament, it can lead into depressions. So it's insofar as there's a kind of message, it's that, you know, this needs to be thought about a lot more, because it's there's probably a lot more depression out there, both untreated and treated.
Sure. And he talks about his symptoms, how he recognised his symptoms, and hoping that by revealing those to a wide audience, people who might be suffering similar situations can recognise them, and if they haven't been conscious of it, as it were, can then seek help if they need it.
Yes, I think that's right. And he sort of says that now, looking back, he can think of other people, and indeed himself at early times of his life, who probably would have, you know, benefited from treatment. They were not functioning well, and you know, there are resources out there, and it needs to be addressed.
Yeah, absolutely. The piece, it's extremely poignant, as Matthew pointed out, and very confessional, very brave. That starts on page 44 of our magazine, and you can see both of those features, Davidson and the anonymous academics. I'm afraid, though, that's all we've got time for in this week's issue review, but of course we would like to hear from you. And you can find complete coverage of the latest HE news and features and our books book section in our magazine and on our website. We would love to hear from you. So please make a comment on any of the pieces discussed in this review, but also in the latest magazine. And you can find us on all manner of social media to do so, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, and of course our website, TimesHigherEducation.com. Please do get in touch. We'd love to hear from you in any way. But until next week's issue review, I wish you goodbye.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.